Burmese Buddhist Diana Pau U.
Coming from Burma, where women's status is very, very high, and we've never really had to fight for our equal rights there, especially in terms of legal and social activities. But when it comes to religion, there is inequality between men and women, because, for instance, we have the ordained monks, but we do not have fully ordained women. The impact of Buddhism as it is now taking root in America, and the women showing so much leadership, I think has had the impact in the sense that I have just, you know, in recent years realized this inequality in the Theravada tradition.
One of the most interesting and unanticipated consequences of the new forms of Buddhism evolving in the United States is the ricochet being felt in Asia. Hierarchies and practices are being questioned. American interest in Buddhist roots is even reviving the religion in some countries where it's been on the wane or almost non-existent, like India. And Asian immigrants and visitors to the U.S. return home with a new perspective on their native religion. The winds blow not only east to west, it seems, but west to east as well. An American Theravadan practitioner describes her experience.
It doesn't really matter to me what the Grand Patriarch in Thailand or what the Council of Monks says about women's ability to be enlightenment. I think that I have a different understanding, and it's my practice, so it doesn't really matter what the status quo is. But I really like the way that Buddhism in America is going to and is currently beginning to affect Buddhism internationally. I can see that there's a very big change coming in Buddhism across the board. And the way the American people accept and learn about Buddhism and transform it into American Buddhism will also affect Buddhism around the world, and I think end up being a very regenerating force in Buddhism.
I think that the presence and sympathies of women in Buddhism in this country is giving concrete support to women in other Buddhist countries to develop their own traditions in their own way.
Anne Klein is a Buddhist scholar and practitioner.
American women, some friends of mine, are working very hard to set up Tibetan nuns in Dharamsala to give them a real Buddhist education that traditionally Tibetan nuns didn't particularly have in Tibet. There's a lot of support from the Dalai Lama, for example, for this kind of education to be available to nuns and women, lay women as well, not just monks. There is a self-consciousness now of the possibility of women in Asia taking more power and drawing more strength and so forth from their own Buddhist traditions.
Ani Pema Chodron.
You now have not just women who are spokespeople for the Dharma, like women teachers, you also have Western men. See, this is as significant as that there are women, is that it's becoming not Asian anymore, it's becoming North American and European. And it's different in Europe than in North America. And in South America it'll be yet again different. It actually kind of speaks to the time that it's in and the culture that it's in.
If you really look into the teaching itself, in that there is no really discrimination between man and woman at all. In fact, woman is the source of wisdom. Woman is seen as the source of wisdom. The man is skillful means. The union of skillful means is the man and the woman.
Sogyal Rinpoche.
Padmasambhava, who brought Buddhism to Tibet, his own teacher, one main teacher, was a woman master. What I see as I now come and teach in the West, that there are these kind of wonderful qualities of these. I think perhaps in that way, how would you say, the form of Buddhism perhaps will change in the West. But I'm not saying Buddhism itself needs any change, because Buddhism itself is fine. in the Tibetan situation, I hope there will be more women masters who would come in future. I think in the West, definitely it's going to happen. Already, there are many, many women teachers.
I was very resistant to practicing, and largely because of the whole question of teacher-student relationships. I was very, quote, American in my rejection and in many ways my misunderstanding of what surrender meant, of what a guru meant, of what having a teacher meant, and whether some of my confusions were on target or way off target. Either way, I was afraid of practice.
The role of the teacher in Buddhist practice varies from tradition to tradition. This may partly explain why this role is so often misunderstood by Westerners. In American terms, a teacher or master or guru might be described as something of a coach, someone to goad and guide you through rigorous training, someone who has been there. Jack Kornfield is both a Buddhist teacher and psychotherapist.
To be a good teacher, in the best sense of it, means that you are someone who has really let yourself face your own sorrows, your own woundedness, fears, and pains, the contractions that create the suffering for everyone in the world. And having faced those and discovered how to release them or transform them, to turn them into compassion and understanding, then you can be a guide to someone else.
If you really meet a teacher, they tell you things you don't want to hear. But a definition of teacher is that you trust this person. So even when you meet your teacher, I advise you to spend a good long time skeptical. I would say, from my point of view, if your teacher is not encouraging you to be skeptical, I wouldn't trust such a teacher. Good teachers support this undoing of belief systems and things, rather than that they become this crutch, and without them, you know, you're this miserable worm.
It's completely unnecessary to accept rebirth, reincarnation, or karma, other than what you can observe directly for yourself. The Buddha said, if you can't see it and test it for yourself, then it's not the true teachings of the Dharma. The notion of rebirth is part of Buddhist tradition in Asia, but we are reborn every moment and every day of our life. There's an ending and a new birth. We can observe the workings of karma in our daily life. If we treat people badly, they begin to treat us badly. If we treat the earth badly, it begins to cause suffering back for all beings who live on it. There's no need to take any set of beliefs in Buddhist practice other than what we can see and directly discover in our own life. I went and confronted the teacher and said, I think I want to go to a better monastery, a Burmese monastery where they're silent all day long and you don't even have to do chanting or chores. I said, and you, I look at you, you don't seem so enlightened to me. He said, I don't? I said, no. I said, you know, sometimes you say one thing, you're not so consistent with people, and how do I know you're enlightened? He laughed and he looked back at me and he said, it's a good thing I don't seem enlightened to you. I said, yeah, why not? I was ready to leave. And he said, because if I appeared enlightened to you, you would still be thinking that you could find the Buddha outside yourself. He's not out here. Now go back to your room and meditate if you want to understand where the Buddha is to be found.
As more and more American-born Buddhists begin to become teachers, many of the teaching techniques and rituals are changing.
We're at a very strategic time in the history of this transmission coming from the East to the West, because there were this wave of Oriental teachers that actually goes back to around the turn of the century, but became really significant in the 1960s.
Korean Zen teacher Robert Moore.
Most of these men are nearing the end of their teaching careers. They're and all will be within the next 10 to 20 years. As the American teachers, the first generation of Americans, began to take over the practice and become the role models and so forth, it's quite obvious that some transformations will have to take place. It will be a delicate balance between losing the power of thousands of years, which is brought to us through rituals and chant, all different kinds of rituals, chanting rituals, bowing rituals, and all of this. It's easy to say, well, let's throw all that away, because Americans don't like that. They don't like all this chanting. They don't like speaking in another language. They don't like eating with chopsticks, this and that and the other. The problem that you always have to balance, though, is whether when you give up the power of all of these many, many centuries in terms of the rituals and the teaching techniques and go completely, say, in 20, 30 years to something else, whether we end up with a kind of pseudo-therapy that we're calling Zen, or, you know, kind of community group interaction that's like group therapy or something, and we just put the word Zen on it.
To flourish, any institution must reflect and enrich the culture in which it finds itself. At the same time, to endure, it must retain something of its original traditions. As Buddhism begins to develop an American face and form, it looks to the East with an eye towards preserving the immense body of ancient wisdom now reaching our shores. At the same time, if it is to take root here, Buddhism must explore and honor the landscape and cultural heritage of the United States. The sensibilities and circumstances of American practitioners are already having a profound effect on Buddhist practice. With surprising resonance, Buddhism is also reflecting the belief systems of Native Americans. In its great migration from east to west, Buddhism has always merged with the nature-based wisdom of indigenous cultures it encountered. In Tibet, for instance, rather than suppressing the whole pantheon of deities and demons worshipped by Tibetans, it merely incorporated them, tamed them, into Buddhist practice, making them protectors and archetypes. What makes the situation so unique in America is that there are striking similarities between Native American and Buddhist spiritual practice and prophecies.
I am Yaqui Indian, and Yaquis are basically natives of the Southwest. I was studying with some elders in the Southwest, and actually in the Navajo reservation, and also in the Hopi during the time, and I was in high school. And I met some friends, the friends that I was working with in the high school that I was going to, was also introducing me to Buddhism. And then at that point, I was about 17, maybe 16. I had met Dudrup Chin Rinpoche. I felt that there was a lot of similarities, anyways, in the event of the Yaqui tradition, similarities in some of the philosophies or the ideas of, like, the four elements. Or the senses, and also how that interacts with our living in the world. And in some cases, reincarnation is taken quite serious in some of the Native American tribes. And again, the idea of deep meditation and prayer. And the dances are actually in some ways similar. Some of the animal forms that they use in the dances, and some of the spiritual costumes, and some of the folk dance steps, and the colors, and folk music is quite similar. So there's a lot of similarities to it.
Over the years, we felt a connection in our heart with the minds of Tibetan people, particularly the mental continuum of Vajrayana Buddhism. And many of our elders felt that Guru Padmasambhava and certain lamas were tuning in when we were having ceremonies. So we feel that we have a relationship with our relatives across the ocean who live in those high mountain places as well. And our prophecies are that when the people wearing the red cloaks would come, that together we would offer a medicine that would transform and purify the aggressive energy and even make the water pure again.
Diani Iwahu is a clan chieftainess of the Etowah Cherokee Nation.
When you consider, well, what does a Native American, particularly a Cherokee, have in common with the Vajrayana tradition of Tibetan people, we can look at the common factors of genocide, that certainly we've been sorely oppressed by what have become dominant cultures who've sought to take our land and crush our cultures. And still, in spite of this, most of the world is very hungry for the teachings of the ancient ones.
Tibetan religion, I've never been there, but I've seen a lot of similarities. They hold the turquoise as a sacred stone to their belief, and then they have passes in the mountains where the trails go over ridges where the passes are. They make an offering to the mountain gods and for a safe journey and successful journey. And so we have the same belief in our country, in the Southwest, where we cross mountain ranges or we go over a ridge, and we have what we call stone shrines. Tibetan religion has those things too. And also the sand painting that they do for their ceremonies, very similar to Diné sand painting. And the way that they use it and the colors that they apply and the way that the deities are presented on the sand painting. Just the whole story around the sand painting, it ties in with our belief, that the Diné people's belief. And so I think that if we ever do connect Native Americans, mainly the Southwest Indians, with the Tibetan people, that I think they can really share a lot of things that's similar, and I think they can even work together spiritually.
Buddhist teachers like Karmapa and the Dalai Lama and others have had historic meetings with Native American leaders. Tibetan Lama Sogyal Rinpoche describes a visit to the American Southwest with his teacher, Dudjom Rinpoche.
And it was really very extraordinary. When Dudjom Rinpoche came to New Mexico in 1976, we met at that time the David Manangi, the spiritual leader of the Hopi Indians, and others we met, and there was a ceremony done together. And during that time, it was remarkable, quite amazing, is that actually Dudjom Rinpoche could understand many of the languages they had. The language was similar. And then also in terms of religion also, there is like the Burmans, which are the ancient indigenous religion of Tibet, have very similar to like American Indian tradition.
Beliefs of ancient cultures from around the world about the nature of the universe has been given new credence in recent years. Contemporary scientists have come to accept a worldview very similar to that of mystics and thinkers thousands of years ago, that Buddhist thought and subatomic physics point to the same phenomena is not surprising, perhaps. Both science and Buddhism are based on the principle of observation.
Physicists have introduced us to the world of quantum particles, a world astonishingly like that described by the Buddha in its image of the glittering net that unfolds across the universe. And just like the jewel in the net, all particles exist potentially as different combinations of other particles. So, when you really look at ourselves and then and the things around us that we took to be so solid and so stable and so lasting, we find that they have no more reality than a dream. Buddha said, "Know all things to be like this, a mirage, a cloud castle, a dream in apparition, without essence, but with qualities that can be seen."
I think the translation of the void for the word shunyata is an unfortunate one. It gives rise to the impression that Buddhism is saying that the world is empty or is nothing, and that is not at all what is meant there.
Physicist George Weissman has studied Buddhism for over 15 years. He's part of a growing number of scientists who are attempting to integrate science into our worldview.
Rather than calling it the void, for instance, Roger Corliss in his book Visions of Buddhism calls it transparency. It's a different sense of things. In science, we find in quantum theory that rather than consisting of things, the world is a process of which we are part, a unified process, and that the process can, for certain purposes, be divided into events. And the causal network that relates these events is the subject of scientific study. The events seem to come out of nothing. They seem to appear, and this is a process which you observe in meditation. You observe the arising, for instance, of thoughts out of some kind of space.
There is no simple cause and effect. Systems theory in the new physics shows that.
Journalist Scoop Nisker has practiced Buddhism for over 20 years.
When you do see the truth of the wholeness of it all and the fiction of your separate self, the fiction of your own importance and the importance of your particular drama, then you start to sort of love all life as yourself. I mean, you see it as, you don't see any separation. So when you see who you really are, out of that comes this great compassion for all other beings and all other things. And along with it comes a kind of an understanding that even though you try to do justice and love mercy, you know, you aren't attached to somehow saving the world. You aren't off there angry and saying, you know, it's your fault. The Tibetans have a great saying. They say, roll all blames into one. Because there's really no evil in the world. There's only ignorance. And if you see that, then you can have compassion for someone's ignorance, the way they're stuck, not blaming them for the way things are, because it's really nobody's fault. This is the melting pot. The United States is the melting pot, and it's very obvious to me that Buddhism is going to also melt in the United States, that we're going to have a little bit of Tibetan Buddhism, a little bit of Burmese Buddhism, a little bit of Japanese Buddhism, a little bit of Indian Buddhism, and they're all going to... there'll be some centers that will be pure Indian Buddhism, but there will be a lot of people who have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it's all going to mix with American kind of, you know, social activism and nature, love of nature, and a little bit of Native American spirituality, and it's going to come out a different creature.
So the old is the new, the east is the west, form is emptiness, and emptiness, form. The cosmic dance continues, and America learns some new steps. In describing the new face of Buddhism in America, it is perhaps fitting to end with Duncan Williams, a young man who bridges east and west and Asian and American Buddhism in a very personal way. He's an ordained monk in the Soto Zen tradition. Born in Japan, he now attends Harvard Divinity School.
I would refer to Jack Kornfield. In an essay he wrote for a book called Buddhism in America, he suggested three things which are particularly unique to Buddhism in America. One being democratization, the second being feminization, the third, I believe, being integration. Democratization meaning the Sangha, the lay followers in the temples, are more responsible for the goings on of the centers, Zen centers, and in other words, the abbots who have traditionally in Japan held a very important and pivotal role has been that role has been de-emphasized, mm-hmm. and it's a more democratic type of community, and feminization. There are several elements. One is that there are more women practitioners. Another difference in American Zen Buddhism, we find quite a few teachers and senior students of teachers in the United States. To go back to Jack Kornfield's third point, which is integration, there's a blending of Buddhist traditions in America, or there's a greater dialogue that's happening. And in some sense, really... a unique moment in the history of the Dharma, and quite wonderful to see too.
Well, we've come to the end of this now. This is Richard Gere wishing you all supreme happiness and the causes of future happiness. Walk on.
East Meets West was produced by Pamela Michael and Sue Supriano and written by Pamela Michael. Interviews were by Sue Supriano. Our engineer was Matt Binder. The production was funded in part by the California Council for the Humanities, the Tides Foundation, the Numata Center for Buddhist Translation and Research, Buddhist Churches of America, Richard Gere, Stephen Rockefeller, Virginia Warner, Pamela Krasny, and Brian Gibson. Special thanks to the Institute of Buddhist Studies, KPFA Radio, David Gans, and especially to Richard Gere for his narration and support. For information about this program, write to the Buddhist Radio Project, 1602 Delaware Street, Berkeley, California, 94703.